Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow night, the famed Auditorium Theater will play host to composer and Disney legend Alan Menken. He's bringing his show A Whole New World of Alan Menken to the stage to tell stories and sing songs from his brilliant career. And brilliant career may be an understatement. The musician has won 8 Oscars, 11 Grammys, and a Tony thrown in for good measure. Menken has been behind some of the best music scores and songs in movie and stage history. Little Shop of Horrors, The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, just to name very few. Menken, along with his late creative partner Howard Ashman, are responsible for the Disney Renaissance of the late 80s. He worked on a new Aladdin with Will Smith, which is coming to theaters this summer. My pleasure to welcome Alan Menken to Extension 720. Great to have you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Where does a show like this come from? I mean, is this a tour? Is this something that you have put together? Because it seems a little bit out of character for you.
Well, you know, the impetus for this was that my career gets so compartmentalized. You know, there'll be like an evening of Disney music, which will feature a lot of my work, plus others. Or there'll be an evening where someone will do Little Shop of Horrors, or there'll be a Christmas Carol, or there'll be, you know, the sister act. I said, but I'd like to have some way to bring it all together in one performance, and also to share stories, the background to the songs. And so I have these 3 screens that have, you know, images on them or information or even a video. And I play sometimes whole songs, sometimes snippets of songs, talk about what led to a project, what came from it, what the feelings were, the emotions, and just share it with an audience.
It's amazing, too, because you have been behind the scenes when it comes to music as a composer and as a musician for so many years. But you started off as a musician, you know, who's on stage and on mic, coming full circle and coming back to that style. Is that important to you?
It's not like, you know, the part of me that wanted to be a singer-songwriter when I was a very young man is looking for this as that kind of release. It's not that. It's just a nice way for me to connect with audiences, a nice way for me to bring my career as an entity into its own arena. Mm-hmm. And there aren't a lot of spaces to do that. There's occasionally an evening of Alan Menken's music, whatever, which is great. What I like about this is I have the freedom to do whatever I want on the stage. There's a structure to it, but, you know, I can go on some tangents. I can just talk to the audience. And I've become aware that there's a big audience out there of people who are really affected by this and love it. And, you know, it's nice to once in a while get out there and be in touch with that.
And we could take one aspect of your career, just as you mentioned about these shows, and spend an hour on The Little Mermaid. We could spend an hour on Little Shop of Horrors. I was fascinated reading about your story, about your early days in New York City, and the decision for you to go all in as a composer, as a musician, to not be someone who does one thing on the side or another and dabble with music. You made a choice at an early point in your life that you wanted to do this work. Take us there. Take us to that moment in the mid to late 70s, New York City.
Yeah, it was in the early 70s. You know, I was in college. I loved music. I felt in my gut that I am a composer, and I always composed, but I came from a family where, frankly, all the men were dentists. We're lousy with dentists. My grandfather was a dentist. My father was a dentist. My father's brother was an orthodontist. My mother's sister's husband. It's just, I could go on and on with the dentists. And clearly, I did not really want to be a dentist, nor did I really have the aptitude for that. And now, as a kid, I was very ADD. I hated to practice. So I was like one of those 60s kids that, you know, when early 60s came and the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and all, you know, that really energized me. Prior to that, I had a background in classical music, and I grew up in a family that loved musical theater. So at a certain point, as I was graduating from college, I go, what am I going to do? I don't want to just get it. I want to be a composer. And I knew instinctually that the best way to get there was not going to be, for me at least, being an arranger or an orchestrator. Although I did work as an arranger and a musical director, and I played nightclub acts, and I would write songs for Sesame Street, and I do anything I could just to make a buck. But I told myself, this is a calling, like the priesthood or whatever. I'm doing this regardless of what the payoff is. I am doing this. And that's what I stuck to, and I just continued to write and write and write. because it's what I wanted to do every day.
Early in your career, you weren't necessarily thinking about musical theater, and you were writing pop songs,
I was rebelling against it. I grew up actually loving musical theater through my parents and my family, but I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I would, when I was at NYU, I just filled notebooks full of, these very personal songs. And I did think about, being along the lines of what Elton John or
Like a rock star.
Jackson Browne. And I love them. I'm the biggest fan. And I do have a catalog of songs that are like that, that, I guess I could unearth someday. But I actually found in musical theater that instead of just, I'm going to make a new album and I'm going to pull it, what am I feeling now? Or what am I saying about this love or this situation or what, just simply from my own life, I subjugated that to telling a story, going through characters, to working with collaborators. And it opened up such a treasure trove of styles and opportunities that I never really looked back with any regret. And now, of course, if you look at Broadway, you see so many of these artists were going, I want to write Broadway shows.
Right. Everyone's back. It's such a great distinction to think about the emotion that flows through a musician to write personal songs. But the emotion flows through musicians to write emotion, meaning you get this opportunity to write musicals or music that is to capture a moment, to capture an emotion, to be a part of a bigger story that may not be yours.
And yet I am Seymour. I am Ariel. I am Aladdin. I am any of the characters. I and the lyricists, we channel ourselves through them. And it's rich. It's really rich.
Yeah, I want to take a break here. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about Little Shop of Horrors. Because at that point, you had started to do some musical work and some off-Broadway stuff. But Little Shop of Horrors is what puts you on the map. Alan Menken, my guest, he is at the Auditorium Theater tomorrow night with his show, A Whole New World of Alan Menken. The Disney legend and a tremendous award-winning composer is in studio tonight here on Extension 720. We'll take a quick break, come back, more of the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Alan Menken is here, the award-winning Disney legend. You have been behind so many projects that mean so much to so many people, whether it be when we're going to talk about Little Shop of Horrors, A Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast. The list goes on and on and on, even to this past weekend. I was watching Wreck-It Ralph with my 11-year-old son, and Alan Menken's name pops up in the credits. But it just shows the depth and the canon of your career. Let's go back to, what was it? It was 19th and 5th in New York City. Above a salon of some sort.
Well, it was the chopsticks massage parlor was in there. It was above.
Maybe not a salon, a massage parlor.
I never went there. And at the bottom floor, there was a nice coffee shop, and it was I think you walked up four flights to get to the WPA Theater, but it also was an elevator when it worked.
And what year are we talking about here? This would be 1970s.
Well, I started there in 78 when Howard Ashman and I were working on God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, and then Little Shop was in 82. First of all, that part of New York became an epicenter because also one block away was called 890 Broadway, and all the Broadway shows were rehearsing there. And so, ironically, that little
spot,
a few blocks in New York, was quite an explosive scene. We had done God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which was a show that got good reviews, had 14 characters and a little band, and was just too big for off-Broadway. And Howard then calculated for the next show, you know what, we're going to have no more than 9 characters. Well, actually, we had 8 characters and a puppet. You know, the voice of the puppet and the puppeteer. And that would price out with a little band. And first we opened at the WPA, which was I think 299 seats. It had to be small enough to qualify for Equity Showcase. I had very intermittent air conditioning. So
as any good off-Broadway theater has, right?
It's a great space. You know, things just exploded out of there.
But what I love about it, and tell us if this is accurate, it felt like, because there were lines around the corner, everybody wanted to see this show, Little Shop of Horrors. So the Broadway creative community, the sort of elite art community, people wanted to be in the audience to see this, what amounts to a late night musical.
Yeah. In fact, we were going to have midnight shows, and then Equity said, no. But if there's ever a show that would have thrived having a midnight show, it was Little Shop. After we were really a smash at the WPA, then came, a lot of different producers came to make bids on producing it, and there was a push to come to Broadway. And Howard very smartly said, no, this is built for off-Broadway. This is built for a tacky space.
But what it did is it showcased you and Howard's creative DIY spirit in this way that you didn't have to put Little Shop of Horrors necessarily on Broadway, because no. Really it was about two of you being able to create whatever was next.
Yes, and at that time you could run a show off Broadway and I think do pretty well. And even now you can, but it requires a lot of investment. And we had as our producers David Geffen, the Schubert Organization, and Cameron McIntosh. So clearly the plan was, just like Audrey 2, you plant that little seed, little Audrey 2's everywhere. Little Shop of Horrors everywhere. We had the production out in L.A. at the Westwood Playhouse, and we had the production in London at the Comedy Theater, and we had a tour. And it just, from there, it exploded.
To hear these stories and to hear you talking about this is a lifetime ago. We're talking about the early 80s. Yeah. Do you recall these memories with fondness? Do you look back on these moments? Because we haven't even gotten to the points that have made you uber famous, a Disney legend. This is you as a up-and-coming artist in New York City, off-Broadway.
But this was that moment where I went, you know what? I can make a living doing this, because I was writing my shows and I was also very involved with the jingle scene in New York and club scene. And I was thinking, well, what am I going to do to really make a living? Because I don't know if this theater thing is going to do it. And I remember telling, there was a man named David Lucas, who had Lucas McFall was a big jingle house. And he kept saying, Alan, come on, we'll set you up with an office and we'll set you up with your own studio. And da-da. I said, you know what? I have one. Let me just do this one show. See what happens. And the show, sort of spared me from that, which wouldn't have been terrible, but it wouldn't really have been the life I want. What was great about it is not only was it a successful show, but it was traditional musical theater, but with a real rock and roll hip score. And that opened up a lot of different doors. And it was a big moment in my life where I said, wow, we're good. And from there, because of David Geffen being one of our producers, that's how I think I connected
to Disney.
I think David probably whispered in Jeffrey Katzenberg's ear and said, this is guy Howard Ashman, especially. And Howard then went out to Burbank and met with them and was discussing a number of projects. And I think much to their surprise, the one he wanted to do was Little Mermaid.
And I want to get to Little Mermaid. You mentioned the hip score of Little Shop of Horrors. And when you think of that musical and you know those songs, they are well known, they are ingrained in our heads. What were you going for? Because there was a rock and roll, but there was a doo-wop kind of vibe to a 50s, 60s vibe to it. Take us through the what you were going for
well,
the score.
First time we were working on Little Shop, we did a score that was kind of true to the Corman movie. It was kind of jazzy and a little bit nerdy and it was hip in its own way, but everyone looked at us like we had three heads or something. It's like, what is this? But then Howard went back, and there's a line. If you look at the old horror movies, those beach blanket horror movies, or if you listen to the Phil Spector apocalyptic songs, Leader of the Pack, that whole sound, it was almost like the end of the world as narrated by rock and roll. So that was the vocabulary that we very much funneled into Little Shop. And it was not just the story of this plant. It was also is the story of the end of the world, so to speak. And it's actually a Faustian tale that has a lot of resonance, for real, but totally in a fun package. And I really credit Howard with the brilliance of that concept. It was so smart. And as soon as we put all those elements together, I knew it was you just could feel it in your gut. It was exactly the right time for that.
It's amazing, too, because, at that time, you think about what was happening in Broadway. You did have a lot of great shows, memorable shows. I think of all the things that were happening in the 70s and early 80s in Broadway, but not that kind of score, not that kind of rock and roll narrative.
Well, my collaborator and friend, Stephen Schwartz, was coming along with Godspell and Pippin, which was the opening the door. He had, a lot of those pop influences in what he did. The year of Rosewater, I remember, was the year of Sweeney Todd. Even though it's traditional Broadway, there was an edge to that score. It was also the year of Evita. And of course, Jesus Christ Superstar. All those elements were clearly, you could feel them coming to energize theater in general. And Little Shop was very much among that.
Do you believe because as you mentioned, that Little Shop really belonged in an off-Broadway, four-story walk-up theater, you know, like to start with that kind of vibe and the way that it was going. Do you believe it would have the same success if it started on Broadway?
No way. On Broadway, if you didn't polish up every aspect of the production and slick it up, I mean, people would go, what am I looking at? Medium is everything. What was it, Marshall McLuhan? Is it the medium is the message? And it is the message. For a musical can be, anytime you're telling a story through music, it's a musical. So Tommy, when it was an album, was a musical.
Right.
Something on television with his songs, that's a musical. Theater is theater. Broadway is Broadway. And now Broadway has evolved to a degree, but when we brought Little Shop to Broadway, how many, 20 years ago now? Time flies. less than 20 years ago, but not that much. And we did shine it up. It was sort of the shiny toy Little Shop. And audiences loved it, but it wasn't the same thing. You know, walking into the lobby of a Broadway house with all of the connotations that go along with that are not all that compatible with, you know, Skid Row. And I think, you know, people, it's good, better if they go to Skid Row and see Little Shop of Horrors.
Alan Menken is my guest. He's got a new show that is going to be at the Auditorium tomorrow night, A Whole New World of Alan Menken. He's telling stories, singing songs from his brilliant career. And we'll take a break and we'll get the headlines for the news. And we come back, let's talk about the Disney Renaissance and your role in it. It's just tremendous. You are a Disney legend, capital L. This is a real thing, yeah. The Disney legend. Alan Menken, my guest tonight in Extension 720. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Alan Menken, my guest, singer-songwriter, composer, award-winning, 8 Oscars, 11 Grammys, a Tony, Disney legend for his work, really with the Disney Renaissance, which movies like Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, music that is so iconic and so familiar, it is ingrained in American culture. I'd say global culture at this point. And you're at the Auditorium Theater tomorrow night to sing some of these songs, tell these stories, and I really appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us. It's amazing. We stopped the story before the news with Little Shop of Horrors, but to make the transition to Los Angeles, to make the transition into movies, to go to scores and compose songs, is it a difference than working on musical theater like Little Shop of Horrors, or is it the same thing?
Well, it's both. It's the same in terms of when you're writing songs that are going to be telling a story, you have to make choices, stylistic choices that are smart and appropriate to telling that story and to creating a point of view about the story. And when the opportunity came to work on The Little Mermaid at Disney, in many respects, I looked at it as my reunion with Howard and our follow-up to Little Shop of Horrors. You know, sometimes when we refer to Part of Your World, I think at Howard or somebody would refer to it as somewhere that's wet, as opposed to somewhere that's green. Because it still is that kind of moment where your central character still has a longing and a dream and all that. And we were hired to create animated musicals that could sit on the shelf, comfortably on the shelf, alongside Snow White and Cinderella and Pinocchio and Peter Pan and all those. So what does that take? Well, first of all, the medium itself in animation allows for a certain kind of breaking into song, but it still is very much based on the musical theater of its time. If you go back to Snow White, there's elements of Sigmund Romberg in there, and there's elements of classic, you know, operetta. So we were pulling from a lot of diverse influences, which is also very much Disney, because Disney pictures, whether it's live action or animation,
right,
they really do go to distinctly different stylistic places and geographic places. They're very conscious of that, and they really thrust music forward. So in the case of Little Mermaid, one of the pivotal decisions was, when it was presented to us, John Musker and Ron Clements had this character, Sebastian the Crab, and Sebastian was a stuffy music director in the court, and he was English. And I guess we could have worked with, like, a stuffy English composer, whatever, but it wouldn't have been necessarily all that distinctive. Howard said, how about we make him a Caribbean crab? Now, part of what I think was in Howard's head also was reggae. We really didn't use reggae that, I mean, it's a little bit of
Steel drum.
Kiss the Girl.
But
you look at Under the Sea, it's really more calypso.
Yeah, right.
But that world of the Caribbean And everything that comes with that opened up a stylistic door. And you have the Sebastian the Crab, and he's very proud, and he's also, oh, very scared. And, you know, and he's a big fish in a little pond, and we adore him. But being able to, you know, capture that and express it through musical ideas, mm-hmm. it just lit up an audience. And then Ursula going to a sort of a Brecht and Weill kind of German cabaret place. Again, it's just every time you can take people to a place, even if they don't understand what place you're taking them to, they know it's a specific place. And it fascinates them. And that makes all the difference in writing these scores, is they are, in a way, drawing on homage. Homage to each of these little winks that we put in there.
It's really fascinating to think that way, because when The Little Mermaid's a great example, where I may not be familiar with Calypso music, I may not be familiar with the German cabaret music you're talking about with Ursula, but I know those songs.
Sure.
And I know that they are iconic songs. I don't need to know German cabaret to know that mm-hmm. song. And there is something about music and emotion and who the audience is, everything that circles around the not just the songs in that, but the score, that it is Disney. And it goes beyond, and I'm not trying to just plant in everybody's mind that Disney is your memories, but this idea right. that it does play. You hear those songs and it takes you to a place, and not necessarily under the sea, but where you heard under the sea.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of things. First, Disney is obviously, it's a huge corporate entity. It's many different things, but if you go back to the essence of what Walt Disney was, it's a purity of heart. And in telling these stories where you have a very everyday, common, innocent central character who has this big dream that's very universal, it has a lot of heart, it's a safe space.
Do you know that going in as a composer? Do you think of that pureness of heart when you're tasked with doing
Little Mermaid? Well, I'll tell you a story. Before I was doing Disney, just before, we had done Little Shop. My daughter was born. We had gotten a farm in Pennsylvania, and I was living out in this farm. It was a beautiful, idyllic location. What could be better in life, except there was this plague called AIDS. It was killing people all around us, in the theater community, in the artistic community, and it was incredibly frightening, because we didn't know. You know, how does it happen? How do you, you know? At the same time, the Disney animated movies, the classics, were coming out in VHS, and I would stick them in the machine, and I'd hold my daughter on my lap, and I'd put on the news. I'd go, oh, no, I can't watch the news. I'd put on some sitcom, which is making light, but it's not sitting right. I can't watch it. Action Adventure, I couldn't watch it. The Disney movies were a safe space. I felt it. I could watch, like, a Winnie the Pooh. It's very innocent, but at the same time, sophisticated stuff. And it just was, I felt in my gut, this is a very important refuge. And I think I took that into the part of my career that works yeah. at Disney, is a sense of that we are creating a safe refuge. And it is sacred, and it's really important. And you screw around with that sensibility at your own peril. You know, that's why certain times, you know, with Hunchback, with Frollo, whatever, you push that edge, and you know there's nervousness, and you have to push that edge. But still, there is that basic core of decency.
The irony of knowing how those Disney films helped you in that moment, and to have your creative partner die of AIDS. It's amazing to look back at such a small career and a brilliant career of Howard Ashman, to really just look at, and you have honored that throughout your career, to see how he has had such an impact and didn't live to see it.
No, he didn't.
How do you feel about that? That point, that the yeah. work that he put forth?
It's one of the most poignant aspects of my life. There's a wonderful new documentary that was actually done by Don Hahn, Don produced Beauty and the Beast and was one of the producers on Hunchback, and also he did The Lion King. But Don is somebody who's very much a legend at Disney. And it's a documentary called Howard. It's going to be available on the new Disney streaming service. Not that I'm trying to promote them or anything, but it's really touching. And it gives you a sense of his brilliance and, yeah, his you know, his flame burnt bright and quickly. And it was tragic. He died before Beauty and the Beast was released. He kept it very secret, even though when you look at the symptoms, we should have known, but, you know, sort of like you block it out. But on the night of the Oscars for Little Mermaid, when we're sitting with our three statuettes, he said, when we get back to back home, we have to have a serious talk. It's, what? Tell me. And he said, not tonight. No, this is a wonderful night. And when we got back to New York, he told me. You know, he said, HIV positive, and it was a death sentence. And he just went downhill, 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 and he died 6 months before Beauty was out. And it was a very emotional time. And I think the emotion of the subtext also had some effect on the work that we did. It was just an amazing time.
It also has to be tremendously warm, and the idea that, Howard's work lives on. And it's, there are many artists where their work lives on after they die. But this work that you guys put together, it continues to be a part of young fans. I mean, someone having a 2-year-old, 3-year-old singing these songs. And it has to mean something to you that the work lives on this way.
It's huge. It's huge. And there's no experience like sitting in front of a Howard Ashman lyric for the first time. And I miss that immensely. On the same hand, I've had wonderful, wonderful collaborators since. Tim Rice, Stephen Schwartz, David Zippel, Jack Feldman, I worked Newsies with, Glenn Slater, Chad Beglin. Wonderful collaborators, but there's something about Howard that was really unique and just unbelievably brilliant.
Alan, our theme in the show tonight is new versus old versus new, out with the old and with the new is what we're calling it. And I thought about this when preparing for this, just about Broadway. And how we kind of talked about, you mentioned about, you know, with Hunchback and the idea of what the traditional Disney vibe is. And sometimes you get too close to the edge, and you got to watch for that. As we see Broadway shows want to innovate, want to change the way they interact with audience, or just do something new. That's what artists want to do. How much do they have to straddle, and how much do you have to straddle in your work, the tradition, which makes this so amazing, this work, and innovating and trying something new?
Yeah, it's all a balance, and it's all in the gut. There's this thing called the gestalt of the moment, or the zeitgeist, and it is the force of the moment. And something can be perfect of this moment, and you wait 2 years later, and it's not quite the same. I remember when A Chorus Line opened on Broadway. It was phenomenal. At the same time, Chicago opened. And it was like, oh, it's old news. It's old. That's old-fashioned Broadway. Chorus Line was so innovative and new. Who would have thought that 50 years later, Chicago would be still running 12 years on Broadway, however long it's been. I don't know how long it's been. It's just an endless run on Broadway. And people, a lot of people don't even know about Chorus Line. That's a shame because Chorus Line was incredible. But it's just symptomatic. Look what happened with Newsies. Newsies was a major flop movie. It just and yet over time people attached to it, and then I won my first Tony Award for Newsies. And the time was right to bring it in. And it's like Peter Allen said, everything old is new again.
Yeah.
And all the new shows that are coming in, look, this Temptations musical just opened, Ain't Too Proud. What are people responding to? It's nostalgia for Motown, for that fun. I think that's why the jukebox musicals work. There's a lot of return when you're doing a new wink at an old style, and people pick up on that. That's huge. And that's what we're always doing. You know, there's always looking for the old to bring that flavor back in a new way. That's where new comes from. There's really nothing new under the sun.
Alan Menken, A Whole New World of Alan Menken is on stage tomorrow night at the Auditorium Theater in downtown, right on Congress, or Ida B. Wells Way now. The award-winning Disney legend, Alan Menken, my guest tonight on Extension 720. Alan, thanks so much for sharing your stories. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.